Gentle space burgers, welcome to the show. Welcome to the space cave. I am in the nether regions of space. It's quiet, pristine, tranquil. Spaceships fly by with loud bass music playing in the background. You can hear that. Quite a scene going on out here. People think there's nothing really happening. It's busy out in space. So many things we miss. All of our advanced telescopes and ability to think that we see out there, we see nothing. They put up fences made of dark matter. They're cloaks. They're hiding all of these wonderful things that are happening. It's a busy, busy world out there. No Twitter phone call this week. That's just probably laziness on my part, and also just a factor of traveling. I don't even know if this bumper will end up being used, but I think it will be. If you're hearing it, it was. So, nothing we can really do to change that now. Sometimes, you know, traveling and things like that are going to get in the way of me being able to sit down and call a complete stranger. But I do enjoy doing that. But, you know, not every episode has to have that, or me calling someone. I thought I would share with you a little tale from American history that you're probably familiar with, but if not, I find it kind of interesting, and I'll try to keep it as brief as possible. And if you know more about this, you probably do, rather than fire off a scathing email or negative comment, get in touch. I'd like to do a series on, like, geniuses, and if you're familiar with Nikola Tesla or Edison, anyone involved in the electricity wars, let me know, because it was a wild time. Edison was on the cusp of sort of providing power to everyone, all of New York City wired up, but at the time it was Rockefeller, John D. Again, this story is going to have a lot of those sort of things in it, so you'll get the gist of it. Kerosene lamps up and down the street, people are having them in their homes, but even like the outside street lamps are blazing kerosene. Oddly enough, a byproduct of producing kerosene, gasoline. They didn't know what to do with it. They were just throwing it out into the river, which, again, back then the sort of environmental concerns were negligible. So kerosene is kind of dominating, but toiling away is Thomas Edison, and he's got his hands on DC current, and he's providing power and establishing Edison Electric, and he is going to revolutionize the world and light it up by having these power plants every few miles that will send a limited range of electricity to people's houses, to street lights. He has J.P. Morgan. That J.P. Morgan as his financier. At the time, J.P. Morgan is one of the wealthier people in the world. His father is the wealthiest person in the world, John Morgan. And J.P. goes to him and says, "Father, I think we have something amazing here we should invest in. Edison has invented electricity. It's unbelievable." And John Morgan says to him, "Well, we have a history of only investing in known commodities. So don't go risking our fortune on unproven things. We bet on proven winners." And J.P. Morgan kind of goes, "I'm never going to get out of this guy's shadow. I got to do it." He goes to Thomas Edison and says, "Hey, you're the only guy doing this, right? You have no competitors." And Edison goes, "Yeah, of course not. It's just me. I figured this out." But what he's really not letting on at that point is he didn't necessarily have a competitor, but what he did have is a guy working in his shop in Edison Electric, in the office they worked out of, named Nikola Tesla, who was not a competitor, but he had stumbled upon AC current and presented his findings to Edison and said, "Hey, I think this is better. This is you can send it a lot further. DC, you know, it's a direct current. You can only send it so far, and you're gonna have to build these power plants like every couple of miles. With AC, you could build one huge power plant and then just send this electrical current alternating as far as you wanted to. You could string up wires and send it all over the place." And Edison said, "Ah, you're an idiot, kid. What are you? You don't know anything. It's too dangerous. It's too, you know, the voltage too high. It's gonna, you could kill somebody with that. It's like the electric chair." And Tesla said, "Yeah, but I mean, you could keep the, God, I wish I knew more about electronics, but keep the amperage down and you'd be fine." "Ah, you're crazy." So one day, Nikola Tesla turns in his resignation papers, says, "Hey, I'm done here. I don't want to do this." And kind of with a snicker, you know, Edison kind of goes, "All right, good riddance. Good luck to you, kid." And he takes his AC current idea and he gets it patented, and then he gets an investor himself. This guy Westinghouse is also very wealthy, not nearly as wealthy as JP Morgan, but they set off on one of the coolest things ever. Tesla, if you're familiar with him at all, had a bunch of terrible things happen. His lab at one point caught on fire and everything was destroyed, and his whole life was kind of this unfortunate set of circumstances where he didn't really receive the credit. He initially invented the radio, and yet somehow Marconi got the patent for it. Tesla's just one of those figures where he should be much more highly acclaimed than he was. So he and Westinghouse set off on this amazing thing where they go not around the country, but they go to certain locations and they give these demonstrations in front of theaters where he's wearing cork-soled shoes and he brings out these big orbs, which you may have seen photos of this before, where he's standing between them and like a wizard, he's conducting electricity from one orb to another through him, and you can see the current, you can see the electricity, and he's going, "Look, this is AC, it's totally harmless. If you keep the voltage down, not that bad." Or again, amperage. I know I studied this at one point, which this episode is timely in that our guest would know all of this and be very disappointed that I am confusing it. Anyway, so this demonstration's happening. JP Morgan finds out about it and runs into Edison like, "You said you had no competitors. What is this? Is ridiculous. This guy's out there causing a big stir in the world." And they'd had these lavish parties where Edison and J.P. Morgan invited over high society, which, you know, had only had candles prior to that, and maybe some kerosene lamps. And all of a sudden, they tell everyone, "All right, hold your breath." And they turn on some switches, and the whole house lights up. And DC current is providing electricity, and this is the wave of the future. And everyone toasts and goes, "Oh, marvelous, this is going to be wonderful." Meanwhile, Tesla and Westinghouse are out there, you know, making the rounds, showing everybody this is actually the future. This electricity is harmless and it can be distributed from much further away than DC. So then the World's Fair is coming to, I believe, New York. Might have been Chicago. Would be helpful if I knew these things. Regardless, there's a World's Fair. They're going to give the contract to one of the two. So Westinghouse and Tesla sort of bid on it. They give their presentation. "Here's why we're better. Here's why we should do it." Edison and J.P. Morgan give theirs. The World's Fair chooses Westinghouse and Tesla. Not only did they choose them, whoever got chosen to do it, if they pulled it off, they would get this contract to build a power plant at Niagara Falls, which Tesla had dreamed of since he was a little kid. So this, imagine that. Imagine if your life, you were a little kid and you were having dreams of giant bodies of water and somehow generating power from that. One, it's a weird dream for a kid to have. Two, to pull that off later in your life is unbelievable. The World's Fair goes amazing. The bulbs are bright. Everyone's basking in them. They build a power plant at Niagara Falls. Everything's going great. Meanwhile, Edison has set out with J.P. Morgan. I don't know if J.P. Morgan was there, but Edison sets out on this sort of smear campaign to show how dangerous AC current is. And you've probably seen these photos as well. He would take a live elephant in front of people and electrocute it just in front of an entire crowd, just destroy it with AC current. Like, "See, look how dangerous it is. Your houses will all burn down." So he was not doing great in the public relations world. It was only fueling the fire that Tesla and Westinghouse were much better. And they essentially had lost. Tesla had beaten him. He had the patents to AC current. But John Morgan passed away. And J.P. Morgan became the richest person in the world. And he went to Westinghouse and said, I want those patents. And Westinghouse said, yeah, good luck. I mean, those are ours. There's no chance legally you can take them. He goes, no, I know that. But I am not going to win in court. I'm just going to keep you in court until you lose all your money. I can do that. I'm the richest guy in the world. And Westinghouse sees the writing on the wall. And in a story like that, you wish that he had fought a little bit more, but he just rolled over. And it probably was a little harder than I'm making it seem. But he just rolled over. All right, here, take the patents. Don't sue me. And so he just steals these patents, basically, from Tesla, and then goes home and tells Edison that, like, hey, good news, I get those patents now. AC current's mine. And Edison goes, oh, sweet, so we're gonna go forward with Edison Electric? He goes, oh, no, I bought all the shares of your company, your own company named Edison Electric. That's mine now, and I changed the name to General Electric. And there's the story of how General Electric got started. Tesla ended up basically living alone in this hotel in Manhattan, where they just let him stay there because they knew how amazing he was, and yet he couldn't pay any sort of rent or anything because he didn't have his patents, he didn't have, everything was taken from him. So that's a very disappointing story, but kind of worth knowing, right? So it might not be a Twitter call, but hopefully you enjoyed that in some way, even though it is really in no way fulfilling other than makes you angry at a lot of people, namely J.P. Morgan. Edison, not so cool either, but Tesla's the best dude. So, you guys, let's talk more about electricity, and let's get into it with a really cool guy. And I don't know if you remember my phone chat in a previous episode with Kim Bowman. This is her husband, and so she was nice enough to put me in contact with a number of people, but this one very specifically connected to her, and studied at Caltech and Princeton, and just a really fascinating guy. And you'll see the episode, we go through all that, what he's up to now, what he studied, why it's important. We are drinking some El Segundo Brewery beer, and we'll talk about that as well. So enjoy my conversation with Sam Mandagaran. Sam from Nevada, so there's a tendency to say Mandagaran, like that kind
of... A lot of people say that way, too.
Mandagaran. Okay, Sam Mandagaran, and we're having this El Segundo Citra Pale Ale. Got a picture of some hops on the label.
It's delicious.
It is? I haven't tried it yet.
It's very good.
You live in Pasadena, you work in Irvine right now.
Yes, I do. I work at a part-time, my friend started. I mean, a startup. I work part-time there, and it's a long drive.
Yeah, man, that is traversing the greater Los Angeles area.
But flexible, I can go whenever I want. I work 2 days from home, so it makes it easier.
Yeah, man, that's
really makes it much more.
You made people at home who are listening have such a goal now. Just choose when you want to go. And do you end up keeping a pretty regular schedule, or you end up...
I do. If I don't, I won't work as well.
Yeah.
So I wake up in the morning if I don't go there, and I say, okay, I'm going to start working at 8, and I'll end at 5, and have an hour break for lunch.
And you really only go just a couple days a week?
I just go 2 days a week, usually Mondays and Thursdays.
Nice. Well, I want to get into what you do and all that, but before we move past this, it is pretty good beer. I like this.
It is. I like
it's
it.
It's straightforward. I'm starting to get to know beers a little better, and I feel like I could recognize that as a pale ale, pretty standard. Because there are some that like an IPA, or, you know, I don't know the differences within pale ales, but this one feels like exactly like a pale ale.
It does. It's a very good summer beer.
Yeah. I figured, you know, I almost got the Angel City Brewery is in Eagle Rock. That's near where you live. And then I thought, El Segundo, I haven't had them yet, and that's closer to where you work, roughly.
Used to work.
Well, Irvine. I figured, like, El Segundo and Irvine are closer than... I don't know. I was trying to make like a leap there, I guess.
You know, El Segundo's right by LAX.
I do.
Yeah, it's quite far from Irvine. They're both by the ocean. They have that in common.
Yeah, I associate them with like the trip down to San Diego. Like, well, I'm in El Segundo, and oh, there's Irvine 45 minutes later. Or it's like an hour, probably more, right?
Yeah, something like that. You go all the way from, LA County to Orange County.
I tried my best, Sam. You're grinding me, man.
Sorry. I just thought maybe you get confused with El Segundo of another city.
Oh, no. And I just wanted to reference Q-Tip, and I think that, you know, leaving your wallet in El Segundo and all that fits right into our theme. That's what you and I love that. We love Tribe Called Quest. And anyway, the beer's good. It is a nice summer. It's still warm here. I don't know when this is coming out, but at the time of recording this, it's warm in L.A., and this beer seems to fit it pretty well. And so what I know from your wife, Kim, about your sort of background real quickly, and then maybe we can branch from that into what you're doing at this part-time job where you're sort of like a hired assassin going in a couple days a week to sort things out. But you got your undergrad and master's at Caltech.
That's correct.
And then you started studying at kind of at both Caltech and Princeton?
Well, I did my undergraduate at Caltech, and then I went to Princeton for a PhD. I left Princeton and came back to Caltech. I got my master's there.
Oh, okay.
And then I left Caltech, and then I went to USC Film School.
Right. And that was the best twist in it to me. So you're like, the hell with this. I want to get into film.
Exactly. Except that I still have to work part-time as an engineer to pay
but
the bills.
But it's like...
it's not paying off. The other side hasn't paid off yet.
But 2 days a week, I mean, if you're going to be in film or the creative arts or something like that, to have... That's the best, is to have a job or a skill where you can work a minimal amount of time and then devote the rest of your time to pursuing what you want to do. Because, I mean, most of the people I know, especially, like, comedians are so broke and they have no skills outside of telling jokes. And so, occasionally they'll get jobs freelance writing for websites and things like that. And that at least offers a little bit of freedom. But driving in twice a week, I mean, you have so much more free time than the average person who's, like, taking the bus to work and working behind a cash register and all the while just thinking it's going to take me forever to make enough money to take even like a week off or to get some studio time or whatever they want to do. So you're in a good spot.
In that sense, I am lucky because I get paid the rate for an engineer. Right now, actually, no, because it's a startup. We don't have enough money, so they gave me a little more stock. It's like, can you please just take less money and get more stocks? And I'm the only employee actually there. It's two founders and me.
Do they boss you around pretty good?
Well, they're my good friends from Caltech.
So they're nice.
I bossed them back.
You're the only employee. I was the only employee one time at a Western wear store, and I don't mean to speak ill of it. It was fantastic. I really liked it, and I was like a teenager. But I was the only person that worked there that wasn't in some way related to the people that owned the place. So they would leave notes like, your mother doesn't work here. Clean up after yourself. I'm like, this can only be addressed to me. And I'm the only person.
You were really the only employee.
Genuinely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you guys are just hanging out in what, like an abandoned garage and just, is it like, have you watched Halt and Catch Fire? Is it like that?
I watched a few episodes. No, it's not like that, actually. Nah. We got lucky, and my boss, my friend, he got a free incubator. So it's more like Silicon Valley.
Oh, okay.
Except that we don't have a weird incubator boss. It's not in a house. It's actually run by Irvine Company.
And is all the language they use, is that similar where you're the amount of money and the upfront things and where you're starting off? And I wish I retained more of the terms that they use, but there are a lot of them throughout that. But do you watch the show? Is that structure pretty similar?
I don't know, because I'm just working as an engineer part-time there, and friend, my boss, takes care of all of that. So yeah, sometimes when I hear him talking to potential investors or current investors, it sounds similar, but it's not as funny, it's not as exciting, it's more dull.
What are you guys trying to do?
Well, we're basically trying to improve the cell phone structure, the infrastructure. So, this buddy of mine came up with this new idea that it could improve
cell phone
towers.
They're so small already. I mean, the infrastructure meaning like getting the signal out to your pocket, to your...
Towers. However, eventually we want to do the same thing on the cell phones and make it better. It's all about making it better, faster, smaller, cheaper. So,
you want to get it to a point where we live in a world where people are no longer complaining.
That will never happen.
So what, I mean, but you would eliminate the majority of what people complain about.
Which is?
I don't have enough bars, my signal, I mean, this thing is slow. You want to focus on those two things mostly.
Well, what we're doing now is not exactly that. It's like we're combining more and more signals into one signal.
Unifying theory.
Yeah, something like that. Because right now there's just a mess of spectrums out there, and they keep on adding spectrums. So your phone has to take care of all these different spectrums, jump to different spectrums, same with the cell phone tower. Mm-hmm. And it's becoming quite a mess, actually. So everyone's trying to find a way to simplify that mess. And that's what we're doing.
Simplifying that signal, but it would still be like Verizon would have their very specific proprietary signal. What's getting jumbled in there now? What means the towers have so much junk around them, I guess?
So originally, say, there was cell phone only operated at 700 megahertz or 800 megahertz, and then they added a new band, 1.something gigahertz, and then 1.7 gigahertz and 1.9 gigahertz, and all the old bands are still running. Mm-hmm. So your phone can access any of these old bands. Now, different companies have different bands, but they keep on adding bands for more capacity. There's more people, and your phone has to be able to communicate with all these different bands. So from just being like a radio that only, like your FM radio that only operated at one frequency, now it's a radio that operates at 10, 15 frequencies. It's constantly switching between them. And now they want to even use them simultaneously so you can have more bandwidth. Mm-hmm. That's something that cell phones don't do right now, but it will happen soon.
Oh, and you want to make that bandwidth be in an FM type signal, but it's just...
Well, when the signal comes in the antenna, you have to do some stuff to it to separate the signal you want, because it's a mess out there. You want to make sure you get your signal. So you do a lot of filtering, and that's what we're doing.
I just was in the mountains, and my aunt found this transoceanic AM radio that, you know, normally you just have you can go along the dial and go up and down the frequencies, but this one you could change the tone and the gain and one other thing. So if you could like just barely hear something, you could fiddle around, and I don't know what it was.
That's
what
very
it was
old
adjusting.
School.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it had this thing you could take out and take log notes, and it felt really like the most important scientist from 1920 or something like that would have that radio. But I was wondering, what in the hell were those knobs for? I mean, tone, what does that equate? Just, is that like simplifying or narrowing in on a certain frequency more?
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Because your cell phone and all your radios does everything automatically. You just, it just finds signal, locks to it, gains, does enough gain if it needs some gain, amplifies automatically, does everything automatically nowadays.
Do you know how it does that? Is it a relay? I mean, how does it, within milliseconds, know that that's the strongest signal and that's the right one?
Well, you don't know it's a strong signal. You know the frequency of the signal that you want to hear.
Uh-huh.
Your cell phone knows that, okay, I'm AT&T and I have to connect to this frequency.
And that's what makes them all independent, is we're 800, we're 850, we're 9.
Exactly.
Ah, I never knew that. Okay.
But then the cell phone company may assign you a sub-frequency, because then within each frequency there's a sub-band, so that my cell phone doesn't get mixed up with your cell phone.
That seems like a very limited... I mean, the base that we have of millions of people with cell phones, it seems
that's
like...
That's why there are multiple towers. Each tower is only responsible for its own little cell, hence cell phones.
But with people traveling, how is it now more common that I don't am driving through Pasadena and I don't hear your signal? Like, oh, we have the same sub-frequency.
Well, first of all, it's digital, so you get your little packet. It's marked with your ID, so your phone knows, okay, this is mine.
Okay.
And then,
but they never fight over it? If say someone was given the same sub-frequency in Oklahoma, but they were driving through LA and we were near the same tower, they don't jostle?
Well, that's the cell phone company's job. So the cell phone company, the tower and their computers assign you a frequency, and it remembers that that's your frequency and doesn't give it to anyone else. And when you're going through, from when you're driving, you sometimes exit one cell tower. They have to hand you off to another one.
Mm-hmm.
It may assign you a new frequency and new ID. In the old days, you remember when you're driving, a lot of times you lose your phone call.
Yeah.
In the old days, they didn't do a very, very good job with handing off. And sometimes when they're trying to hand off, they'll lose you.
Yeah.
And that was common. Nowadays, they've become better. They do soft handoff. Like, they don't completely let you go until the other antenna has picked you up and stuff like that. And there's more capacity now and all that stuff. And sometimes you enter the cell tower and there was not enough capacity, so they had to drop you.
Oh, because mine will give me a message sometimes that says... Essentially that, like the network is busy or something.
Yeah, basically all the bands are full. And cell phone companies hate that because it's not good for them, which is when they start adding more towers in the neighborhood if it's too crowded and stuff like that.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. I have T-Mobile. What's your carrier?
AT&T.
How do you like them?
They're better now. They're much better now.
T-Mobile's, they're customer service is really good, but the I still run into driving and getting calls dropped pretty regularly, and then they'll show you, like, this is our map, we have really good coverage, and it's not that good. But I like, and I don't really travel outside of the areas enough for it to be a huge problem. But it, hearing this, it makes me almost want to, you know, when you reach those ends and your call is dropped, especially when it's kind of cutting out, it's almost like they're little Laverne and Shirley just frantically trying to find a new frequency to hand you off to, the soft handoff, and then they don't, like, ah, we had to drop.
Well, too bad for you. Yeah. However, sometimes something else happens. You go in a dead zone. You just can't
see
the antenna.
There's nothing there.
You're in a tunnel, or you're in the bottom of somewhere that, for some reason, you don't have a good sight or view from the antenna, and you just, there's not enough signal. That's
okay.
That's usually the main reason these days your phone gets dropped, because they've become very good in handing off. The handing off part is not an issue anymore. It's really, you just too far away from a good antenna, or something's blocking the view.
Like, say you initially got your electrical engineering degree, you're just naturally prone to it. What made you want to study electrical engineering and then pursue it and then narrow it down to cell phones?
Do you know, those decisions are really weird. You don't make those decisions very consciously. I did electrical engineering because that was a cool thing in the 90s when I was in college. It was the up-and-coming thing in engineering,
I'm saying. Okay.
If you're an engineer, it's like the top engineering students didn't go to mechanical engineering. When my dad, he's in mechanical engineering, when he, in the 60s, that was the hot engineering. All the good students went to mechanical engineering.
I feel, and, when I was studying, I did civil, and I feel, I saw a number of people leave that and go to mechanical, and I thought it was still the cool one.
I forgot you're an engineer too.
Well, kind of. I wouldn't, I guess I passed the tests and I have a degree, so.
You are an engineer. You're just not practicing.
Not practicing and probably not very good at it, but I think it wires up your mind to always be kind of like, well, I could hang out with engineers, I think, to some degree and understand
that. Yeah, you should come to our parties.
I would love to.
Half of my friends are filmmakers, the other half are engineers, and we get them all mixed up.
They get along well?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's problem solving and, you know, creativity a lot of times is just connecting two things. And I always felt like with math problems and things like that, you have to be pretty creative in how you're like, what am I missing here? And you have to think a little differently.
And be imaginative sometimes and try to make it out in your head and see the gears working.
Yeah, I went to school with a lot of people who weren't necessarily the most gregarious or outgoing or, like, funny. A lot of guys weren't very funny, but they were weird.
They're just extreme nerds. Is that what you're saying?
They're just very methodical. Yeah, really analytical.
I know. I went to school with many of those guys, too.
Yeah.
Some of them improve over time. Some of them stay the same.
There was always, you know, kind of like the person who'd wear wacky shirts or have strange just kind of overall getup or frizzy weird hair.
Or walked around barefoot.
We had many
of those in college. They're still around.
They're all, campus, yeah, that's any campus, there's always going to be like, I think I'm going to be the frisbee barefoot guy. So, okay. Well, I don't feel that disconnected. A lot of times when I think of engineering, I'm like, oh, I'm such a fraud to pretend that I have anything to talk about.
You studied it. You are an engineer.
It's just been a while.
You just not practice. Yeah. And I have to admit, it's kind of funny. I never felt like an engineer when I was in school. It took me 10 years out of engineering school before I felt the confidence, okay, now I can design any circuit I want. It took that long.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of practice for all the stuff you learn to start sinking and becoming part of your, just that you can feel. It's like, okay, now I can just pull up something and design something simple.
I think there is maybe a not a maturation process, but sort of like marination maybe, where it does start being so practical that you just know it. Yeah. I think with me, there are a lot of things where I go, oh yeah, how does that, I learned this at one point and it's just
you're just
gone.
Not using it. But if you start using it tomorrow and after a few years, it'll be the
it'll
same
thing.
It'll
come back. Maybe it's like a foreign language or something.
Oh, it will come back for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may have forgotten your differential equations, but trust me, it'll come back very quickly.
Oh, good. Okay.
And I'm sure you've taken that class. If you're an engineer, you must have taken differential equations.
I did. I ended up getting a minor in math and I took second order partial differential equations.
I hated that class.
I remember
the most difficult.
I didn't understand it at all. And the professor came over to me at one point and just said, dude, you're one of the few undergrads in here. As long as you just show up and write things down on paper, I will pass you.
So it was a graduate course you were taking.
Yeah.
Well, you were brave.
It was kind of the only option I had. I knew I had to graduate in 4 years. And so, I mean, that was kind of what I was, and I liked it. At that point, I was really into math, but it was frustrating to essentially have someone say to you, like, you're not a genius, and no matter how hard you try, you're really not going to get this. You need a lot more like base classes before this starts to make sense. So I remember writing down problems and the few that I understood and just being like, I know my brain is not going to retain this, but I want to write it down to remind myself that at one point in my life, I could look at this and solve it. And it might as well be, you know, hieroglyphics or something. It looks so bizarre with the weird sort of two-shaped things and DXD. The language in math is, it starts to become like lines and dots and
it becomes graphical.
It starts becoming more and more abstract. And people that start saying like, oh, I don't understand math when it's like fifth and sixth grade, if they only knew how, I wonder what it's like even well beyond, where it's people probably just touching fingertips and it's like alien type communication.
But I think at that level, it doesn't come easy for anyone. I went to school with a lot of people that you really call genius, and they had to work their butt off.
It's good to know.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception. I think the media has emphasized that more, that some people are just genius, they just get it. No.
Yeah.
At some point, everyone had to work hard, even the most famous scientists and mathematicians.
I think that's an Einstein quote that's like, whatever your difficulties are in mathematics, I can assure you mine are much greater.
Yeah, I'm sure they were. And now it's even worse with string theory and all this stuff. Math is so insane.
And in the waiting period, which, you know, in those major discoveries has been 50, 100 years, a lot of times, sometimes much longer. And now, because people have publicly stated, like, I want to have a unifying equation or theory, we're sort of waiting day in and day out. Like, what's taking you so long? We're really rushing it, where it might be several generations of people before that, right?
Yeah, it's. I think we're going to physics now, and I used to do a lot of physics. I originally wanted to be a physics major, so I took a lot of physics class, and I follow physics a lot. But yeah, physics is just not as romantic as it used to be. In the 50s, 30s, 40s, you have someone like Einstein come up with relativity on his own, and in his 20s, and it's amazing, and I'm just, these other guys came with quantum physics on their own.
Yeah.
But nowadays, like the last paper that they discovered, the gravity particle, there were like 100 authors on that paper, I think.
The Higgs boson?
Yeah.
One? Yeah.
That's not romantic anymore. They spent a few decades, a few $1 billion worth of equipment, and the paper has 100 authors on there. It's not the same as you went to your garage or your lab and you did things, your student or on your own, and discovered this amazing thing and get a Nobel Prize.
Oh, you have there's an artistic, I can see why you went into film school now, because to equate that, to you, sort of physics has kind of become pop music, where you have 20 people writing lyrics and coming up with beats, and it's sort of the Beyonce versus Beck argument at the Grammys, where you like... So does that inspire you to then, within electrical engineering or circuits, or to be the one published on, like, this is my record, I made this circuit, I changed this?
Actually, that's why I like working in startup, because I'm the only guy designing the circuit right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm supposed to design the circuit. I was doing it this morning before I came here. And I'm the one responsible for it. And
yeah.
I do everything and I show it to my boss and he looks at it. It's like, well, why don't we do it this way? When it was like, okay, I go back and do it. It's just me. I love it.
Do you need help sometimes? Where do you go if you need help?
Oh yeah, my boss is much better than me. He's way smarter than me and much better engineer than I am. And
really?
So, well, that's why he's the founder and I'm not.
But he has that mind where he can handle business side of things too.
Yeah,
and
he's actually pretty amazing. He's very versatile. He's very a people person. And
because, I mean, it started over the years to become more common that there's sort of like Jobs and a Wozniak. And in this situation, to me, it's like, oh, well, you were kind of the Wozniak in there working away, and he's just kind of out.
No, I'm not Wozniak. I'm not that weird. Even though I love Steve Wozniak. He's a great guy. I've read a lot about him.
But you're kind of, I guess you guys are both the nuts and bolts people.
Well, he definitely is. He's an exceptional person. Even at Caltech, he got his PhD at Caltech. We were office mates there, and he's truly exceptional. And that really good, both engineering and scientifically, and very good with people. And
that's pretty rare.
It is rare. And he's already very successful, and I'm sure he's going to be way more successful in the future.
Nice. That's a good guy to be tied. And he's a nice guy?
Oh, yeah.
Ah, that's frustrating.
Maybe you'll meet him one day. Maybe you should come over here and you should interview him.
I'm very intrigued. Yeah, maybe we can get him in here. Because I mean, people that have that much stuff going on, is like successful, really bright, nice, well-adjusted. That doesn't seem fair, right?
It doesn't. Life is not fair.
But if you solve this, your name will primarily be on it?
Well, it's a company, so there's no name really. It's really about money, I guess. I have a little share there, not remotely as much as him, but...
Well, let's get into the science of it. I mean, for starting more broadly with, like, if you guys get this, will it say AT&T now powered by...
No.
Nothing like that.
Do you know what's in your cell phone? There's a lot of thought that went into a lot of these little chips in your phone.
I know, but like marketing and branding and Angus beef and Cisco systems and Intel inside and these things that people really don't know, but they kind of go, oh, Angus beef, that must be the best beef. These cows are up there exercising all day. Those lazy other cows, but this tastes horrible.
No, because it just would be another component inside, say, the circuitry that goes in the tower.
Mm-hmm. So when I drive through really nice neighborhoods, I assume the person figured out how to make blue and yellow turn to green on a Ziploc. They put the little end plastic thing on the end of a shoelace. Those are the things that sell billions of whatever they make, and yet they're so inconsequential, and yet as you add them up, you have a mansion. Within the cell phone, within technology, bits of code, software, you guys will have something that's in there that it would be kind of the equivalent of that?
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully we won't fail, and hopefully we'll do it right, and it'll be useful, and people will use it, and they'll buy it.
You got to invite me.
I will.
I'll be on your yacht one day, and people...
My boss's yacht.
No, your yacht.
He has 10 times more shares than I do.
We're fighting for you, man. It's got to be your yacht.
Besides, I'm doing my part-time film thing, so maybe I'll just shift back and start making documentaries or something. I don't know.
Is that what you want to focus in with film?
No, actually, I mainly studied writing and directing narrative.
Okay, yeah, because you not only strike me as someone who would want to make films, but kind of, did you ever read Infinite Jest?
No.
Oh, okay.
Should I?
I think if you like writing, there are a lot of people who say, no, it's a terrible book, it doesn't go anywhere, but just for the, it just works on the fringe end of your mind of kind of, I don't know what's going on here, and then all of a sudden it ties back in. And
I really like it.
It's really interesting, and it's challenging as a book, and I think that the writing's just beautiful. If you want to see, it'd be like watching a mathematician just have 1,000 feet of chalkboard space and just go nuts solving and working equations back into each other. And I don't know that that actually exists, but as far as writing goes, it's like watching someone play an instrument beautifully as a solo, on and on and on. Anyway, there's a filmmaker in that's obsessed with kind of the uniqueness of lighting and how do you capture a shot and a scene, and it's meant to be so aesthetically pleasing. Even like James Cameron, as much as he gets sort of I don't want to say lampoon, but he takes like some criticism for like, well, unobtainium, come on, buddy. But creating his own cameras and figuring out ways to shoot things and that in ways they've never been shot before.
Well, he was a technical guy. I don't know if you know that. He started out as a physics major when he was an undergraduate.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Which explains all his stories. He's really into sci-fi. Yeah, he started out as a physics major, and then he switched to, I think, literature because he just wanted to graduate quickly and start doing film stuff. And so, yeah, he has a technical background.
So is he kind of your inspiration to some degree?
He's one of them, yeah. I love all his movies. And
nice.
I've studied Terminator 2 so many times.
And are you familiar with... Oh, Terminator 2 is so good. Are you familiar with the internal dynamics of cameras nowadays?
I know cameras very well because it fits into both of my interests, electrical engineering and film.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to film school first, I started film school 2005.
Okay.
Digital cameras were still, they were just not as good. People didn't use them in filmmaking as much, actually at all yet. And all my classmates were film only. I was the only one who was like, digital only. And just wait a few years, you would not want to shoot on film.
Yeah. Some but you never wanted to go in there and cut it the old-fashioned way?
We had to, okay. I had to shoot film. I was one of the last classes that we had to shoot our second term on film, which was nice.
Yeah.
I got to learn it. And it was nice in that sense, so I know how to shoot on film, and I did a fairly good job, but I just prefer digital. And that's probably because of my background, too. I just love electronics. I understand it really well.
How? Yeah. Just even as you were a kid, you could kind of, you never wanted to take a fork and jam it Like an outlet?
You just, yeah, I did. I got the electroshocks many times. I built little circuits and I plugged in. I instead of using battery, I used power and I shouldn't have. And I blew the whole fuse in our house and my dad confiscated my whole circuit. It's like, you're going to kill yourself. You can't play with this anymore.
How old were you?
At that point, I remember 13, 14.
Just building circuits. And I remember...
And they never worked, by the way.
Oh, they did? No, I mean, did you have something as simple as like trying to, you know, make a light bulb light up, or people would do capacitors like in science fairs? Did you do stuff like that?
Very simple stuff, and half time it wouldn't work, and still a lot of my circuits don't work. I spend more time debugging them than designing them.
So it's the artistry, it's the creating of them that it appeals to you the most. Oh, like, yeah. Building them,
that's the fun part about, I think, every field. That initial creating part is the fun part, then you spend 95% of your time trying to perfect it. And the same with filmmaking, just all that little details, and same with engineering. The fun part is the first 5%. Mm-hmm. Then it's the grind. Now actually, yeah, find the product, put together, debug it, perfect it, tweak it.
Yeah,
I don't care for that part.
How do you get away from that? I mean, I run into that with stand-up stuff, or I have friends across, you know, varying mediums artistically. They're like, oh, it's fun to envision this art project. Once you start putting pencil to paper or welder to metal or whatever it is, then it just becomes tedious work to see it through.
I know how you can get away from that. When you have a lot of money and you hire people to do the rest for you. Just like Conan O'Brien, or yeah, they don't even come to jokes all the time, but you know what I mean. They have a whole team of writers that takes care of all the little details. Same with if you're that top engineer in a big company, mm-hmm, you come with the big ideas and you have a whole team of engineers that do the dirty details for you.
And you're one of those dirty details engineers now.
Right now, I'm all of it because I'm the only employee. So I come up with the idea, I implement it, I do the details. And so it's all of it.
That's got to, I mean, that's got to feel good though, that you are, if it works, it's, you're going to be the guy.
You just said if, that's very important.
Should I not say that? Did I jinx it?
No, I don't believe in jinxing, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's right. Engineers, no jinxes.
I'm very in that science, and I don't believe in any sort of superstition.
So you, I bounced around a little bit there, but I feel like we're getting to, you know, to... I'm understanding how you operate a little bit. I'm always fascinated by people like that, like tinker with things as kids and then pursued it as they got older. Because there are a lot of people, for myself, I tinker with things, but, and then I studied engineering enough to, I'm still someone that, like, if a piece of technology is broken, I'm not the go-to guy. They don't go, hey, Dave's an engineer. They go, does anyone know how to fix this? I'll fiddle with it and sometimes have some success, but like electricity especially is not intuitive to me. Doesn't really make sense.
It's not intuitive for anyone. It took me forever to get a feel for it too. Trust me.
Oh, okay.
We don't see it in real life. When you don't see it, it's just not intuitive. And over time, you just create this little mechanism in your own head that works for you, and it takes years until that mechanism becomes part of your thinking, and it just works for you.
So it's almost like playing an instrument or understanding, you know, chord progression, or
exactly, because I tried to learn music theory and I failed miserably and I never continued. So for me, it's just a bunch of abstract things.
When you're, I think you would enjoy Halt and Catch Fire. You said you watched a couple episodes and
it didn't stick with me as much.
The first season's a little slow, but then I thought the second one really picked up.
I'll watch it.
And when they're building the first computer in the first season, especially like post maybe episode 5-ish, it really starts going. But watching these guys, and they do, you know, it's a world I know nothing about, and when they are sort of plotting out how they would build these circuit boards, just the connections you have to keep in your mind, in spite of like having it written out and going, here's a physical representation of what we're trying to build. How do you keep all that contained?
It's not hard at all. Trust me, it's not hard. It's you just do it so much, like anything else in this world, it becomes second nature. Also, okay, you do it systematic. That's the whole thing. Mm-hmm. No human being, no matter how smart you are, you cannot go beyond a certain complexity. That's why we build it in modular pieces. We build it hierarchical.
Okay.
Because it's just not possible. No human being can comprehend beyond a certain point. Yeah. So you take care one corner, you know that corner works, it has an output and input, yeah, then you can design the other section, and just like Lego, you put it together. So you basically make it possible for your brain to comprehend.
Okay.
People doing it, they're not that much smarter or that much different than the rest of the people. They just have that experience and they've figured out a systematic way of doing it.
This is really reaffirming. I mean, you seem like someone who doesn't really, and every time I try to think this, then I meet someone who's genuinely intelligent and or genuinely dumb, and I go, oh, it's not the case. There is definitely a scale. But you seem like someone who kind of says, the human being, just given its default setting, is pretty capable, is pretty bright.
Exactly, I believe that, yeah.
Everyone's able to achieve these...
more or less the same thing. Some people are a little smarter.
Yeah.
But it's not that gap that the media or movies like make us believe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I went to school with true geniuses. Some of my instructors were Nobel laureates.
Yeah.
Yes,
I felt that
smart,
way too.
But yeah. But they're regular human beings, and they struggle with a lot of concepts too, and except that they just put the time into it and they learned it.
See, that for me, like the time thing, I mean, I would be, me and my friends, my two idiot friends, would be in the engineering lab.
Why'd you say idiot?
Well, I mean, we really were hard on ourselves because we had to work the hardest. It was just, if it was like a roster, the whole engineering school, we were not the weakest links, but we definitely put in the most hours. It would be like the equivalent of like a football team, and we just didn't put on muscle. So we'd always be in the gym like, well, eventually this will set in. And there were, like you say, those genius people who seemed to barely open the book and just could kind of waltz in.
Are you sure? Did you follow them every day, every minute of the day?
And so you think it was like a put-on? They were faking
it? Some people, certain things do come easier. But this is my conclusion. No one is good at everything. Some people are really good at one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They could even be idiot savants. But when you're becoming an engineer, just like becoming a writer or director, there are too many skills you have to master.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to fill in the rest. You have to put the time for the other stuff you're not very good at.
Okay.
And engineering particularly is very like that. Some people, I had a classmate, he was amazing in math. I'm just amazing. He got it so much quicker than I did in all the classmates. But he had to put the time in the other sections, physics and some other areas.
Yeah.
No one is good at everything. This is my conclusion, too.
I mean, that makes sense. I see that equally as much on the artistic end. And it's weirder because a lot of times people will play into things. I think if you associate engineers in more of like the Asperger's spectrum of almost robotic, I can just look at a Rubik's Cube and solve it, or I can solve a math equation and not really know why.
And there are people like that. There are idiot savants.
Mm-hmm. But I think there are people who aren't necessarily the idiot or the savant part, but they're up in that end of the spectrum where they just get that sort of stuff. They might be able to converse with us pretty naturally, but there's a compulsion or a predetermination that, like, I'm pretty good at this. On the other end, with artists and kind of the flighty lifestyle, I think there's more of an inclination for like an affectation to do that. If people go, I'm weird and I'm artsy, and then they create this fake art or this horrible art, they can kind of go, who knows what art is? And that's terrible. I mean, that you're faking it. You're not really. And then again, you know, people who can barely clothe themselves, they're outside chasing after butterflies. I mean, they just seem genuinely kind of like, I don't know what that is. I mean, it's
kind of
out there and kind of, yeah, I mean, they're definitely not going to sit down and figure out a math equation. They're the type that, I mean, I know quite a few of them just from being around, and I'm sure of the film world too. There are people that are like that, that they're just kind of, those seem to me the two opposite ends, I guess. The art side, really kind of, their desk would be a mess and there'd be paint all over the walls. And then the engineer were like, the pencils are numbered and they are stacked in a certain way.
Engineers, they're the full spectrum too.
Yeah.
I know engineers that are messy. They look like Einstein. And I know engineers that are very tidy. They're very clean.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole spectrum. Yes, there's a little bit of a stereotype. I do agree. The stereotypes exist for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are more engineers that are not as outgoing or a little goofy or...
Yeah.
When you look at the average, but there's the whole spectrum, just like artists. The difference between artists, you can create a really bad, stupid art and you claim it's art and no one can disagree with you.
Yeah.
With engineering, it either works or it doesn't. So, at least when it comes to science and engineering, there's a definite metric at the end of the day. So you can act crazy and stuff, but if your circuit doesn't work, well, it doesn't work. So you didn't do your job.
No, I love that. And I always try to, and that can be a hindrance sometimes, especially in comedy. I mean, I have friends that are math-based who've since gotten into comedy, or people just that are inherently kind of, that's how their brain works, and they'll get so frustrated at someone doing well in comedy. That joke doesn't make sense.
Are people laughing?
People are laughing.
That's it? Then he's done this at the same
but
comedy.
But you look back in 10 years, or even sometimes 5 or 2 years, and you go, yeah, why did everyone laugh at that?
He got them to laugh.
But how? Why? What do they do?
He just looks funny. I don't know. Some people, you know how some people just look at them, you want to laugh, and some people have that gift, and
Yeah, I guess the stuff that has like longevity, or like Andy Kaufman, or whoever people would, you know.
Oh yeah, that's represent. True art.
It still
stand the test
up.
Of time. Yeah, like you watch Sunset Boulevard. It's mm-hmm. Kim, my wife, and one of my favorite films too.
Mm-hmm.
Stands up after
it
60
still
years.
Does. Yeah, he's so personable, and he's just sincere and earnest, and he just had that quality. Like there is that thing there where like it's just how he looked or it's how he said it, but below that is the stuff that lasts a little more, that is, if there were like a joke robot or an algorithm you could feed the joke through, it would come out on the end and be like, nope, checks out, that's a good story, that's a good joke. But I don't know how you do. I mean, so often people want to do that. How do we?
I don't think you can ever figure out. You know how you look at best pictures, you go back in years, look at best picture,
mm-hmm.
every other year you feel like, when you especially go further back and over time has passed,
yeah,
every other year it seems like it was a really good movie and a really bad movie. It's like, right. How did they give best picture to this movie? It's the same thing. It's almost like every other one when you go back down and list it.
I guess I haven't spent a ton of time doing that, but there are movies when they come up that everyone saw
and loved it.
And loved it.
And critics loved it too.
And it didn't win anything.
Or vice versa. Or even everyone loved it, wins everything. Then 10 years back, you look back like, that was a dumb movie. How do we love it so much?
How do you feel about Forrest Gump?
I love Forrest Gump. Actually, Forrest Gump, as you know, I grew up in Iran. I was born and raised in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Forrest Gump a year before I came to the U.S., and that's how I learned my American history.
Really?
Yeah. Of course, being an ignorant teenager, I was watching Forrest Gump, and it's like all the stuff that happens, and my mom's, and I'll ask my mom, what's that? And my mom's Asian American, and she'll tell me, oh, that's the hippie movement, and that's this, and that's that. And I was like, okay. So not only I love the movie, but that's how I learned my American history before I came here.
That's really fortuitous that I brought up Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
I brought it up because it gets associated now. I feel people kind of being scathing or critiquing it and going, oh, it was a gimmick. It was a gimmick movie. But at the time, we all loved it. The critics
still love
it. And I do too. I mean,
it makes me cry still now. When Jenny dies.
Oh, when Bubba dies. I mean, it's impactful. I think for me, I mean, I know there are probably, and that's with everything. I mean, the art is so much more subjective. People, even in science, like things that go and later are proven wrong, people don't go back and, oh, an idiot. That was terrible. That was dumb. They go, well, for what they had to work with at the time, that was really great. That was progressive. It's just a little wrong, but they have no problems with books or anything subjective. Ugh, I can't believe people used to like that. It's terrible.
Forrest Gump's great, and it, like a lot of movies that stand out, it defied some of the rules. Like the character never changes.
Yeah.
He's the same guy. He changes everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
He's an agent of change, which automatically makes you like it, because you feel like, even if you haven't studied all this nonsense in film school, that, oh, there's something different about this.
Mm-hmm.
This character just does his own thing, and somehow he just changed the whole world unknowingly, and he never changed himself.
That's got to be something that you, as an engineering mind, and I don't mean to say, I mean...
Oh,
that,
say it however you want. Don't worry. I won't get offended.
No, but per our conversation, we've established that, like, that is a bit of a stereotype, that there's an engineering mind, and yet... We can both admit that, like, you like the equation to be solved, or...
I know what you're getting at.
Okay.
No, with filmmaking, I realized, I tried to do that first. I read every screenwriting book out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of formulas in the screenwriting book. Very quickly in film school, I realized it's all nonsense. There are some rules that most films sort of follow, but when it comes to art, you don't have rules, and rules are meant to be broken. It's not like physics engineering. It became obvious to me.
It's true. I mean, that... I think that's funny that so many movies, when you watch them, you go, oh, that's Save the Cat. That's that formula.
Oh, I hate that book.
Everyone that I respect as a writer who's attempting to go, like, hates that book, and yet goes, but you do need the 3 acts. You do kind of need a conclusion to your conflict. You need some stakes. You need your characters to overcome something.
I would say you don't need 3 act. It happens that most good stories become a 3 act.
Mm-hmm.
Which, this is my philosophy about it. You don't start a story in saying this is going to be act 1, 2, 3. That's just mm-hmm. my philosophy. You just write the best story. Most time will be a 3 act story. Sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
Look at Run Lola Run. There's no 3 act in there. I mean, like, we can bring up so many movies that are great. Like, try to tell me where the 3 acts are. Of course, some people forcefully would say, this is the end of act 1. They're so religious about it. But,
right. Did you see It Follows?
It Follows, no.
The horror movie?
No. I'm not a horror person. That's the only genre I don't watch.
Oh, okay. It's not that scary. And it was one of those that got a lot of buzz. And I just, as a math person, thought it was insanely stupid. It's someone that, it's like an STD that you contract, that the person, some entity that can change shapes, become people you know, or a stranger, but it's always, it's usually naked and just kind of slothily moving along. But wherever it is in the world, it's always slowly moving toward you at the same speed. It can.
So you're saying a horror movie was not logical. I'm sorry. is there something wrong with that statement right there? If you want to go after pure logic, I don't think any horror movie will work in that sense. So maybe only 1% of them.
If it's supernatural or paranormal or there's something where like, well, when you go into these woods, I'm into that.
Yeah, set the rules and finite number of rules.
Right. But when the rules have been established, where like this thing's going to basically walk after you at a slow pace, that just becomes, we'll drive this far at this speed.
But they don't. That's what makes you frustrated.
I can't. And I don't know if that makes me just a human being watching it, or if that's a little bit too much of an engineer watching it going like, this is a math problem. I mean, you just send them in a direction and then turn around and head back. You're fine. You'll never even see them.
Yeah, movies that frustrate you, those are the movies that bothers me too. Speaking of math that doesn't work out, I love Aronofsky, but his first movie, Pi,
I haven't seen that.
Bugged me, because it's all about this guy that finds this equation that solves everything. And the movie did well, obviously it kickstarted his career. And most of my non-engineer friends love that movie. But I was driving back from Big Bear with my filmmaker friend, and he was like, what do you think about Pi? It's like, I hate it. And he's like, why? It's like, because it just doesn't make sense. And he's like, I understand that. The whole premise bothered me, so I could not just stay interested in the movie.
Yeah.
You should watch Pi and tell me.
Yeah, I'm intrigued now. I am going to write that down, actually.
Tell me if you've...
Is it just Pi?
Yeah, just Pi. Okay. Like the word 3.14.
Okay. How far can you go in Pi?
Actually, not very far. Just 1.415... which usually round to 1.6. That's it. See, I'm not a memorization person. I'm in that camp that you should never memorize anything. It either should.
I thought it was 1.415.19. So you went round to 6.
We don't even know the 4. Did you look it up?
I'm gonna look it up.
I think it's 1415, like 9 something 9 6.
Okay.
And then 4 digits more than you ever need in real life. So 1416 is good enough.
But that
are you looking
three,
it up?
Yeah. 3. Oh, you're right. 1.59. Okay,
and
it's not 1.5.
Is it 6 after 9?
No, 2.6.
Oh, couldn't even get that right. So I only knew.
That was, I mean, in a lot of the Rubik's Cube in some campuses or, you know, school settings is, not to say the nerd's toy, but it is kind of like, it's become some sort of...
I don't know how they do that. There are some Celtic people that solve in like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I still spend an hour solving it.
So I think the world record... You still solve it though?
Well, yeah, it takes me just an hour or something.
I mean, I haven't tried it since I was a kid, but I would get like one or maybe two sides done and then just be like, God, the hell with this.
That's the problem, getting one, two sides done, but then when you try to get the other side done, the other side gets messed up. That's the trick. It's like, oh, I just fixed this side. Now this side got messed up. Oh. And this was frustrating about it.
No, completely. I mean, I look at that as, and memorizing Pi as far as possible as kind of
They learn a technique. It's not that special. You learn a technique. I don't have much respect for when someone just masters a technique, and it's interesting. But
well, I want to find out who does inspire you, and we'll take a little quick break here. Come back next week, talk more about film, more, and really get into electrical engineering and circuits and microchips and all that. But we'll take a little break real quick. How are you enjoying the beer?
Oh, I love it.
How did you?
Do you have a second one?
I do, yeah. Okay. I'll go get one right now. In fact, I have that wheat beer, if you don't mind. We'll try that.
Let's try that.
Okay, cool. Well, okay. We'll be back with more Sam Mondagaren.
That's right.
Right after this. Ah, isn't he good? I like that guy. And there's more next week, so come back and stick around for that. We'll have more El Segundo beer. It's good. I'm surprised I didn't know more about it. That one we had is good, and then the one next week, as far as I remember, even more delightful. So we talk more about electricity and art and entertainment and culture and startups and all that stuff. So until then, I believe this is another one from Casual Strangers, and check them out, especially if you live in Austin. Their tour dates on their, I think they have a Bandcamp page or Facebook, I don't know. It's on thespacecave.com. So if you live in Austin, go check them out.
The next Junk show is back in LA, finally, after a little hiatus. We'll be back at the Copper Still. It's going to be December 13th. A lot of great acts. I recorded this before the London Junk show, which was a couple weeks ago, so maybe I'll edit and fill in and describe how that went, because hopefully it was fun. I know there are a lot. Matthew Robbins was on the show, and Adrian Todd Zuniga, and some people I have never met before, so hopefully that went well. But why am I going into this? It has no bearing on anything other than to say come out to the Junk show. They're real fun, back in LA December 13th. And if you're an expert and you want to talk, if you're a musician and you have music, get in touch. Use the contact page at thespacecave.com. Love to sit down and have some beer and chat with you. And if you're just enjoying the podcast, thanks. I appreciate those of you who've, you know, spread the word and whatnot. So anyway, here's another one from Casual Strangers from Austin, Texas. A little bit psychedelic. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.